The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Susan Hennessy. This is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, May 29th, 2019. So we're here together on a Wednesday afternoon, a few hours after Special Counsel Robert Mueller, or now former Special Counsel Robert Mueller, delivered a surprise press conference this morning announcing the formal closing of the Special Counsel's office, giving a few thoughts on the finding of the Russia report, and making a pretty clear statement that he doesn't believe it's appropriate for him to speak further on the topic, including in congressional testimony. So this is either the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning or the beginning of the beginning of the end. I think we've sort of lost track at this point. But here to unpack all of this with me, I have in the studio Quinta Jurassic and Paul Rosenzweig. And Ben Wittes and David Chris are on the line joining us remotely as well. So before we start with questions, Mueller's press conference was only lasted about 10 minutes. So why don't we take a moment and just listen to what Mueller said in his own words.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. 2 years ago, the acting attorney general asked me to serve as special counsel, and he created the special counsel's office. The appointment order directed the office to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. This included investigating any links or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the Trump campaign. Now, I have not spoken publicly during our investigation. I'm speaking out today because our investigation is complete. The Attorney General has made the report on our investigation largely public. We are formally closing the special counsel's office, and as well, I'm resigning from the Department of Justice to return to private life. I'll make a few remarks about the results of our work, but beyond these few remarks, it is important that the office's written work speak for itself. Let me begin where the appointment order begins, and that is interference in the 2016 presidential election. As alleged by the grand jury in an indictment, Russian intelligence officers who were part of the Russian military launched a concerted attack on our political system. The indictment alleges that they used sophisticated cyber techniques to hack into computers and networks used by the Clinton campaign. They stole private information and then released that information through fake online and identities, and through the organization WikiLeaks. The releases were designed and timed to interfere with our election and to damage a presidential candidate. And at the same time, as the grand jury alleged in a separate indictment, a private Russian entity engaged in a social media operation where Russian citizens posed as Americans in order to influence an election. These indictments contain allegations, and we are not commenting on the guilt or the innocence of any specific defendant. Every defendant is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. The indictments allege, and the other activities in our report describe, efforts to interfere in our political system. They needed to be investigated and understood. And that is among the reasons why the Department of Justice established our office. That is also a reason we investigated efforts to obstruct the investigation. The matters we investigated were of paramount importance. It was critical for us to obtain full and accurate information from every person we questioned. When a subject of an investigation obstructs that investigation or lies to investigators, it strikes at the core of their government's effort to find the truth and hold wrongdoers accountable. Let me say a word about the report. The report has two parts, addressing the two main issues we were asked to investigate. The first volume of the report details numerous efforts emanating from Russia to influence the election. This volume includes a discussion of the Trump campaign's response to this activity, as well as our conclusion that there was insufficient evidence to charge a broader conspiracy. And in the second volume, the report describes the results and analysis of our obstruction of justice investigation involving the president. The order appointing me special counsel authorized us to investigate actions that could obstruct the investigation. And we conducted that investigation, and we kept the Office of the Acting Attorney General apprised of the progress of our work. And as set forth in the report, after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the volume two of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider. The department's written opinion explaining the policy makes several important points that further informed our handling of the obstruction investigation. Those points are summarized in our report, and I will describe two of them for you. First, the opinion explicitly permits the investigation of a sitting president because it is important to preserve evidence while memories are fresh and documents available. Among other things, that evidence could be used if there were co-conspirators who could be charged now. And second, the opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge. So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime. That is the office's final position, and we will not comment on any other conclusions or hypotheticals about the president. We conducted an independent criminal investigation and reported the results to the Attorney General, as required by department regulations. The Attorney General then concluded that it was appropriate to provide our report to Congress and to the American people. At one point in time, I requested that certain portions of the report be released. The Attorney General preferred to make the entire report public all at once, and we appreciate that the Attorney General made the report largely public, and I certainly do not question the Attorney General's good faith in that decision. Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress. In addition, access to our underlying work product is being decided in a process that does not involve our office. So beyond what I've said here today and what is contained in our written work, I do not believe it is appropriate for me to speak further about the investigation or to comment on the actions of the Justice Department or Congress. And it's for that reason I will not be taking questions today as well. Now, before I step away, I want to thank the attorneys, the FBI agents, the analysts, the professional staff who helped us conduct this investigation in a fair and independent manner. These individuals, who spent nearly 2 years with the special counsel's office, were of the highest integrity. And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Okay, so Quinta, setting aside for a moment sort of what this all means about Mueller's willingness to testify and where we might go from here, in terms of the substance of what he said here and what was actually contained in the report, was anything new and was anything significant in Mueller's statement just now?
So there was nothing new, though I think there are certainly things that are significant. I would say Mueller really showed his hand right at the beginning of his remarks when he said it is important that the office's written work speak for itself, which is a point that he reiterated again. And what he's really doing here is just going through in a brief overview the substance of the report. He starts by talking about Russian interference in the U.S. election running through the various indictments that his office secured and prosecutions. Then he goes, so that's volume one, then he goes into volume two, talks about the obstruction half of the investigation and says very clearly that the office chose not to make a determination on whether or not the president obstructed justice because they interpreted the Office of Legal Counsel's 2000 memorandum to bar them from going down that path. And it's a very clear expression of the reasoning as put out in the report. But it doesn't actually contain, I don't think, any new information per se. And so while it is absolutely notable that the now former special counsel felt the need to come out and state this publicly, perhaps to communicate it clearly to people who hadn't had the opportunity to read the full report, I don't think it is right to read this as some publications are presenting it as, you know, dropping a new bombshell about deliberations within the special counsel's office or information that the special counsel's office uncovered.
So, Paul, how about you? What was your big takeaway listening to this?
Well, I agree with everything that Quinta said, and yet I think it is more significant an event than that summary gives it credit for. First, I want to thank Special Counsel Mueller for doing this on a Wednesday, not on a Friday, so that we can do this without ruining weekends. But I think there's actually two things about what he did that are performative, if you will, rather than substantive, but in their performance make a substantive point. The first is that he spoke at all. Right. The report itself is a dense 440-plus page report. Even the summaries are dozens of pages long each. It is highly likely that very few people in America outside of the people who listen to Lawfare probably have read any of it. It's certainly the case that almost none of the members of Congress have done so. So he is giving a face and a voice to these conclusions, which makes them far more salient in a physical and audio way than the written words. So even though he wants the written words to speak for themselves, written words on a page, as anybody who's ever seen the difference between reading a play and seeing it performed knows, written words lack kind of the immediacy of a performance. And he gave us a performance. Much of what he said was word for word what was in the report. But having Robert Mueller say aloud, if we could have cleared the president, we would have, we did not, is a change, is something that's going to be on dozens of news channels for the foreseeable future. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that even though he made a point of saying that he did not question the bona fides of Attorney General Barr in releasing the edited volume and then not giving out his stuff, in fact, he's questioning Barr's bona fides precisely because what he has just done is read publicly his summaries, not Barr's summary of the summaries and not the entire report. He's just said, this is what I want you to take away. And even though he said, I'm not going to say anything bad about Attorney General Barr, simply by doing something that Barr did not do, he's providing a contrast with Barr's performance, both in the letter that he sent to Congress and in the public release of the report that he did, the press conference just before the public release, that is kind of implicitly saying, this is how a prosecutor should act, and I am acting in the best interests of the nation and in the best traditions of the Department of Justice, and I am making the inference, and Barr did not.
So, David, how about you? You're someone who's read the report quite carefully, I presume, and has been following this closely. Watching that press conference today, you know, do you think that there's new significance either along the lines of what Quinta mapped out or Paul's points?
I agree with both Quinta's points and Paul's. My main takeaway from this was that Mueller was saying about seven different ways, would you please read my report? Please read the report. Don't subpoena me, because if you do subpoena me, I'm just going to read the report and probably do it in a halting monotone. And it's got everything I have to say on this topic, and I don't have anything to say on the topic that is not in the report. And this is really serious stuff, both the interference and the obstruction. And okay, I will make one legal point clear to you that is, by the way, already in the report, and that is that I couldn't charge the president. And if I thought he was really innocent, I would have said so, but I didn't. That too is in the report, which I think you should read, by the way. And please just read it, because this is fairly serious stuff. And I'm returning to private life. Please don't subpoena me, and have a nice day reading my report, which I think you should read.
So, David, help me unpack one point that was in Mueller's comment, and also, you know, you sort of picked up on it there. And that's that, you know, Mueller again underscored that because they couldn't indict a president, they weren't even going to accuse him. But then he also, right, they weren't going to determine one way or another. But then he also once again says that if they could have determined that the president did not engage in criminal wrongdoing, they would have done so. They did not exonerate him. To me, even, you know, 6 weeks after first seeing it in the report and now hearing him say it again, that seems to me to be like two inconsistent statements, that they didn't decide not to make a choice one way or the other. They decided that they couldn't clear him. And so then they just kind of left us hanging on the logical inference that the absence of exoneration is.
Yeah, I think this. No, I think you're right, and I think it falls under the heading that Quinta started with, which is sort of nothing new, but not necessarily nothing significant here. Mueller has been criticized from both directions for this sort of split the baby approach that he took here. He's been criticized by some for failing to make the core prosecutive judgment of guilt or innocence, which is discrete and separate from indictability. That's the judgment that Attorney General Barr was able to make very rapidly, which is, okay, even though he can't be indicted, and regardless of that, he actually did not commit a crime. Mueller did not make that judgment, even though he could have without bringing an indictment. And he's been criticized for that. On the other side and from the other direction, he's been roundly criticized for sort of effectively turning the burden of persuasion on its head and saying, well, we didn't exonerate the president. And if we were, you know, if we could have, we would have, but we didn't, which many people, I think, on the political right have said, well, wait a minute, that, you know, that's not how our system works. You don't sort of say you couldn't find someone innocent. You either indict them or you don't. And he held to that line. I think it will be debated for years to come. I think it is questionable from both directions. And it's in some ways the most notable prudential legal judgment that I think he made.
So, Ben, we'll come to the sort of the question about what Congress should make all of this in a minute. But before we do that, what was your reaction or sort of takeaway based on Mueller's presentation today and sort of what he's done thus far, to the extent this sort of represents, the end of his say on the matters?
I wish we were in more disagreement than we are, because it would make for a more interesting discussion. But I actually agree with everything that Quinta said, everything Paul said, everything David said. And the only thing I would really add to it is that I think a huge amount of the message of what he was saying was directed at Congress. That is, when David emphasizes that the overriding message here is read the damn report, the question is, who's he talking to there, right? And when he says, you know, I don't want to testify, please don't subpoena me, I'm just going to read my report, he's talking to Congress there. And I think specifically he's talking to Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And what he's saying is, you think or you want me to ride in like the cavalry and give some dramatic presentation before your committee wherein I do all the work for you of creating the political groundswell that will allow you to do whatever it is you're going to do, whether it's impeachment or something else, and you want to use me as the guy on the white steed who comes in and you know, and presents a dramatic hearing and makes that happen for you. And I got news for you, Bucko. That's what the report is. And it's not my job to translate that into whatever political action you want to create out of it. That's your job, because you're the guy who's got an elected constituency and who's answerable to voters. And by the way, you're the person who has the impeachment authority, not me. And so, I mean, my major takeaway from the thing was, this is Bob Mueller saying to Congress, don't ask me to be, you know, your Ken Starr, who, you know, gave the Starr report and then came in and testified about it and advocated on behalf of his conclusions. You know, I'm the guy who did the factual development work. I presented it. I have nothing to say beyond it. And by the way, part of that process was determining that there was no basis for me to move against the president. And so if anybody is going to move against the president, and he says this explicitly in the statement, as he did in the report, both times in a kind of backhanded way, but he says very clearly the remedy here is not a criminal remedy, it's an impeachment remedy. And I didn't make those rules, but I'm going to play by them. And I think he's, you know, A, being consistent with the report, whether you think consistent in a fashion that is good or bad or attractive or unattractive. But I think a huge amount of the message is directed at Congress, and it's a way of saying, stop asking me to do your job for you, or stop asking me to make your job easier for you.
So, Paul, Ben just mentioned Ken Starr. You worked on the Starr investigation. Are you surprised by Mueller saying that it's inappropriate for him to testify? Right, Starr was an independent counsel, but this is about as radically a different approach as one could possibly take. So is this just a big cop-out by Mueller?
No, I don't think so. I think it is actually, as Ben said, telling Congress, you know, do your job, right? The contrast is not just between Starr and Mueller, but between Starr and the Watergate investigation, for example, which proceeded as if Congress were an independent investigative authority. It had, we now know, a roadmap to places it might want to go, but it understood its job as an independent delving into the facts. Not that it had to necessarily redo the whole thing, you know, to quote the president, but that it had this independent authority to examine the question for itself and reach its own conclusions, which would be based not on criminal law, but on constitutional parameters of high crimes and misdemeanors. I, for one, have long thought that one of the great failures of the House in the Clinton investigation was to not do its own investigation, was to have as its only witness on the issue of impeachment an individual who had absolutely no firsthand knowledge of the case. Right? Starr was not a percipient witness. He was a summary witness, like you might call an FBI agent in a criminal trial to kind of summarize the case for you. But that's no substitute in criminal law for getting the people who know the facts, who were there at the meetings, who participated in the conversations. And I have long thought that one of the reasons that the Clinton impeachment failed to generate the interest of the American public in the same way as the Nixonian ones was because Congress didn't make any effort to generate that interest. That maybe they would have failed anyway, I don't know, but they didn't even try. And so Mueller is going back to, I think, the traditional and appropriate zone of prosecutorial activity and saying, I've done my job. Now you go do yours.
Okay, so even accepting Paul's premise that Congress should undertake its own investigation and should be thinking about bringing people like Don McGahn and Corey Lewandowski and sort of all the various players before Congress, you know, one thing that Mueller was clearly indicating is people should read the report. He doesn't think people have read the report, both in terms of the American public and Congress. You know, Quinta, it strikes me that one way Congress might tell the American people the substance of the Mueller report is by having Robert Mueller come in and talk about it. And so I'm curious whether or not you accept this premise that Mueller's job was writing the report and it's done, and that means that Congress now should sort of, you know, be done with his voice on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really noticed in his remarks is this point where he says any testimony from this office, meaning any testimony he would give to Congress, would not go beyond our report. And then he says, the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that, which is already public in any appearance before Congress. And the implication is obviously, you don't really want me there. I'm not going to give you anything. The way I reacted when he said that was, great. Like, go up in front of Congress and just read the report. Because the way that the press and Democratic members of Congress, including now at least two Democratic presidential candidates, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, are reacting to these remarks is basically as if Mueller had given a new piece of information about obstructive conduct by the president, about deliberations within the special counsel's office regarding whether or not the president should be subject to an impeachment inquiry, and saying, coming out in Harris and Booker's case in support of an inquiry. And as I said, and as we've all said, there's nothing new here. So the fact that these short remarks have generated so much outcry and interest among opponents of the president, I think itself demonstrates first off, that Mueller is right to be frustrated that no one has read the report, because clearly no one has read the report. And second off, that it actually makes a big difference for the special counsel to come out and just say what the report said. So I confess, when Mueller said that, I was somewhat baffled. And my conclusion is really that, sort of in the same way that Barr seems to be a little bit at sea, perhaps, in today's media environment, Mueller is kind of demonstrating a similar unease in a very different direction, obviously. Barr is sort of, there's this aspect of being stewed in right-wing media, I would argue, whereas Mueller, his approach is just to remove himself from it entirely. But I think that really betrays a misunderstanding or a refusal to understand or something of how people consume information, that no one is going to be able to pick up a 450-page report, and that people really do need that information communicated to them in a more accessible way. And in this case, the accessible way is having Mueller read it to them.
So, David, do you, sort of setting aside the communicative aspect of how you get people to read the report, do you accept Mueller's premise that the report speaks for itself? There aren't any ambiguities or questions, or to your mind, are there any ambiguities or questions that persist after this report? Or is Mueller right that he really has been as thorough and comprehensive and clear as we could possibly expect him to be? And so any kind of testimony really just would be duplicative of what he's already written.
Now, I think when you write a report of this length and complexity, there is always room for really, really careful and serious questions about, like, well, how is it that what you said on page 396, you know, relates to what you said on page 244? I don't understand this paragraph, and what did you mean by this? But I think, so inevitably, you could imagine an extremely erudite, careful, productive discussion about that, but it's not the kind of discussion one could ever possibly have in Congress, and certainly not in a hearing. And I think Mueller's basic point is, you know, let's crawl before we run. And can you please just get at the fundamental narrative of this, the basic elements of what I described and found and reported to you? And if, you know, maybe way down the road after that, we could get into these more technical questions about any gaps, conflicts, or ambiguities inside the report. But the main thing is really to just get the basics. I think Quinta's last comment, and I'm sorry to continue the tradition of violent agreement among the panelists here, but I think Quinta's last comment is sort of apropos of that, which is, on the one hand, he doesn't want to come in and testify because he feels like it would be duplicative of reading the report, and he's just going to read the report. And on the other hand, you know, that would be a major newsworthy event, even if he literally just read the report, sock puppet style. And it might actually increase the, you know, penetration of the narrative of the report to the American people, which is what he, I think, wants to have done. He just doesn't want to have to be the one to do it.
So, Ben, you just posted a pretty lengthy piece on where Congress should go from here. How do you think the Mueller's statement today, or his signal on his willingness to testify, you know, where does Congress go from here?
Yeah, so I have been, and for everybody on Twitter who's at me about how quickly I wrote that piece, a confession: I have been working on this piece without knowing that Mueller was going to make this statement for a few days, and I've been thinking about where does Congress go from here. And what Mueller did today is he really forced the issue, right? Because if you're a congressional committee and the cavalry sends you a smoke signal that we're not coming, guys, you know, this is on you. And that's what Mueller said to them today. And so I think, you know, this really crystallizes the question of, okay, so if you're Congress, what do you do now? And my basic argument in the piece is that almost every aspect of Congress's strategy, with a couple of important exceptions, has been wrong. And so Congress is focused, first of all, on getting the full unredacted report. And I think that is a fool's errand, both because there's not likely to be dramatic new revelations in the small percentage of the report that's redacted, and also because at least some of those redactions are legally compelled, and the courts are not going to order Congress, order the executive to turn over grand jury material to Congress. In addition, Congress has largely not tried to dramatize the Mueller report by having live witnesses. And the vision seems to have been get Bob Mueller to come here and read his report, rather than, as Paul's criticism of Congress in the Star episode reflects, what the right way to do it, which is, hey, you know, he mentions dozens and dozens and dozens of witnesses. Why haven't all of those people received testimony requests? And to the extent that they have not scheduled testimony yet, subpoenas. And the strategy, in my view, should be to focus relentlessly on putting, you know, redoing the investigation in such a fashion as to tell the story in a language that Donald Trump would actually understand, which is television that could actually generate good ratings. And so my basic view, and the piece lays out a kind of strategy for how to accomplish that, and along the way to establish the legal principles that Congress gets to do these things against a recalcitrant president who doesn't want to be investigated by Congress. And so there's an intricate sort of set of legal priorities that the piece lays out. But the basic argument is Mueller told you today he's not going to come tell the story for you. You got to tell this story yourself. And it's not going to be by getting, as Quinta says, somebody to read the Mueller report. It's going to get the real players to act it out.
Honestly, what this makes me think of is, for a long time, I think I've been thinking of Mueller in this detective role as you say, Ben, as kind of a storyteller, you know, spinning this narrative that we could only see bits and pieces of. And obviously, we did get the story. We got the report at the end of it. But, you know, in Sherlock Holmes stories, for example, there's always the moment at the end where you're kind of in the dark, and then Sherlock Holmes says, you know, aha, I'm going to explain to you how all these different pieces fit together into this overlying narrative. And with the Mueller report, we're sort of in this weird position where he has gathered the facts and put them together, but it's a little like, you know, Sherlock Holmes basically dropping a giant volume on the table and saying, you read it, and then walking out of the room. Like, there is this weird resistance to being the storyteller, even though that is functionally what the space that his role has put him into.
Right, but I think this is a really interesting analogy and a really illuminating one, because what Mueller is saying here is, I'm not Sherlock Holmes, I'm Conan Doyle, right? And I'm actually the guy who writes the report, and I'm dropping it in your lap. There is no Sherlock Holmes, right? I am the recorder of the results of the investigation. I've merged those two characters. I'm the recorder of the results of the investigation, and I am assiduously refusing to decide what to do about it. I'm not deciding as a criminal matter, and I'm not telling you what to do in your role. I'm just giving you the information. And if you ask me to do more than give you the information, I'll read you the telephone book. I mean, I'll read you what I wrote, but I'm not going to do more than that. And I think the question for Congress is, okay, so if you were counting on Bob Mueller, what's your alternative way of of if you want to keep the focus on create focus on the president's conduct, and maybe you don't. Maybe you want to talk about health care. Maybe you want to talk about, which members of Congress are saying racist things, right? Maybe you want to talk about child separation. There's lots of things to talk about. But if you want to keep the focus on the president's conduct with respect to this set of issues, it's on you, and you're going to have to do it by developing the actual fact witnesses, not going to the sort of chronicler and asking him to be your Sherlock Holmes character.
So I would offer two thoughts, which is, first, I think he actually already did his Sherlock Holmes bit. He did it today, right? The typical opening statement at a hearing is 5 minutes long. He gave us 9 minutes. So he gave us a double-sized statement. And if he came and had read that exact same statement in front of the House Judiciary Committee, what would thereafter follow would be 5 hours of tendentious who shot John questions that would in each instance say, as I said on page 27 of the report, or as we said on 463, or that's not in the report, so I'm not going to address it. So he did the really interesting and important performative stuff already. I wasn't persuaded that he needed to come in the first instance, as I've said, but he pretty much said, look, and here, you can use this for me. The other part of this is kind of interesting is that I want to kind of take this to a slightly higher level. We have been debating on this blog and in these podcasts for 3 years the extent to which Trump's norm-destroying behavior generates norm-destroying behavior by his opponents and whether or not we should be resisting that. We've talked about that in terms of leaking from inside the intelligence community and things like that. I think that Robert Mueller, in this regard, has done us a service by saying, I am not going to be a norm breaker. I'm a prosecutor. I got the prosecutor's job. I didn't even do a counterintelligence investigation. We hived that off. Somebody else did that. So my job was criminal law and criminal law only. And I didn't even make a public report. I gave it to the attorney general. And he decided to make it public. So it's on him. So he's pretty much saying in a very direct way, don't ask people to do jobs that they're not supposed to do, like help you do impeachment. I agree that he's pretty much saying to Congress, cavalry ain't coming because my job isn't to be the cavalry. I'm the infantry over here, and we're holding the ground. You go off and do the rest of the war yourselves. So I think both in he sort of tried to answer Congress in his talk today, and by not going any further, he's staking out a ground that says, normal behavior in America does not have prosecutors doing what can start it.
So, David, Nancy Pelosi has already sort of weighed in by, thanking Robert Mueller for his patriotism and, basically saying we're going to keep on keeping on and sort of continues to be quite hesitant about pursuing impeachment. To the extent that Mueller has properly now dumped this in Congress's lap, what should they do, right? Ben just mentioned that, maybe they should be focused on child separation and all of these other various potentially quite politically salient issues. Based on what the Mueller report actually says about what happened and about what the president did, what do you think sort of the obligation of Congress is at this point?
Wow. I would like to slightly avoid that question and just sort of describe a little bit what I think is going on and where I'm a little uncertain about what she is doing as opposed to what maybe she should be doing. I think the Democrats have a fundamental struggle right now, which is sort of whether to play to the base or play to the middle. And I think whether and how they take on these Mueller findings and run with them, either in the direction of impeachment or impeachment hearings or in some other way, is subsumed under that broader political calculus about whether to go to the base or the middle. Mueller, I think, harbored, or people placed in Mueller a lot of their hopes and dreams. That is, political opponents of President Trump. They were hoping he would indict. If he couldn't indict, they were hoping he would at least make findings of guilt. And if they couldn't make findings of guilt, they were hoping he would at least unearth really, really exciting new facts. And if he couldn't do that, at least that he would pull it together in an extremely compelling narrative that was as exciting and as compelling as his speaking indictments on the IRA and the GRU. And Mueller really didn't do, you know, any of those things. A lot of the facts that he described were already in plain sight. That's the frog in the boiling water norm erosion problem that we've all talked about a lot. And the report is so long and dense, and it's well written, but it is unavoidably long. And so I think, you know, what I am left wondering is strategically, you know, when Pelosi expresses reluctance or hesitation about impeachment, is she just trying to sort of get enough momentum around this report so that, you know, the horses are really raring to go and then she will lift the gate? Or does she really believe that that's a bad idea? Or, you know, or is she looking for some mixed strategy where she has impeachment hearings that peak, you know, right around, say, October 2020, and then ideally, in part because of that, the president loses re-election and the impeachment is mooted? Because I think she is also concerned that to allow this 448-page report to land and not pursue at least an impeachment inquiry may be very problematic for the long run. So I am not a politically sophisticated person and so could not advise on how one should do this, but that at least is my sense of the kinds of assessments that the Democrats are now sort of wrestling with. And although Bob Mueller does not want to come and testify, and as I said and as Ben said, I think if he is subpoenaed, he will read them the phone book, that reading of the phone book in and of itself, just like this little 9-minute press conference, would be a newsworthy event and might, as Quinta was suggesting, itself be part of the strategy that Pelosi may be pursuing to just keep on building the momentum, keep the attention on, get the horses really chomping at the bit, and then at the correct moment, strategically and politically, okay, reluctantly give in and let Jamie Raskin have and Jerry Nadler have their impeachment investigations and proceedings, even if it's not an actual impeachment in the strict sense.
So who wants to take the bait where David refused, the cautious, careful lawyer that he is, on making the sort of the reckless political calculation on, you know, what Pelosi actually should do?
So I will happily take that bait. They should begin an impeachment inquiry. I cannot believe that it is even slightly controversial to say that. I don't even know what to say at this point. I mean, I definitely read Mueller's remarks today as we've discussed, you know, not only read the report, but Congress, do your damn job, right? I'm not going to help you. I've given you everything you need. Just do your job. And frankly, that was clear the day the report was released, because there is information right there. It's not even buried deep in the report. It's on page 1 and 2 of volume 2. You don't have to read very far to see that he, I would argue, is framing the document as a kind of impeachment referral. And the fact that over the last month, Congress has really, well, the Democrats in Congress, frankly, have just been kind of twiddling their thumbs and saying, well, on the one hand this, on the other hand that. And it took a Republican congressman, Justin Amash, God bless him, who has been out there basically saying, look, if you read the report, it's really bad. I think Amash has gone farther and actually said that Trump should be impeached rather than just saying that there should be an inquiry. But that alone is notable. And I think it is, frankly, it should be shameful to Congress that Mueller even had to come out and make this statement to try to push them in the right direction. And it will be even more shameful if after this, they continue to sit on their hands and dither and do nothing. And Pelosi's statement certainly presents Congress as continuing to push back against the president. She talks about continued investigations and oversight. But I would argue that what's really key here is Mueller says, you know, there is an alternative constitutional mechanism to holding a sitting president accountable for wrongdoing. He doesn't say what it is in his remarks, but he's very clear in his report. That mechanism is impeachment. It's not, you know, general oversight. It is an impeachment inquiry. And I am struck by how, in the same way that Mueller, as Paul says, has really been hewing very, very close to his designated authorities to try to play his role as careful as possible. And he's kind of been balancing himself against other actors who are just all over the place. I mean, the president, Bill Barr, who are really not operating, I would say, in good faith. In a similar way, here you have Mueller, who's, you know, sort of acting straight as an arrow, not going anywhere beyond his remit. And Congress that is not, you know, coloring outside the lines in the same way that Trump is, but is just kind of standing there and shrugging. And so you have this weird spectacle where in the constitutional system, there's functionally only one person who's doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing. And because he's so committed to only doing that, he's sort of left what he's done on the table and no one else is picking up the slack.
So I'm going to speak in partial defense of Nancy Pelosi.
Now we have the conflict.
First off, just as a beginning matter, I don't think that impeachment is a constitutional mandate. It's a constitutional option. The framers understood it to be a fundamentally political judgment, not a criminal judgment. And so the right lens for me to look through at this through is the political lens of accountability, but colored by a longer-term sense of political implications. And let's gameplay it out. If Nancy Pelosi begins an impeachment inquiry and it doesn't result in impeachment, Donald Trump will say, see, not even the Democrats could impeach me. If they do impeach him and he's acquitted in the Senate, he'll say, see, it was just a partisan Democratic thing. The Senate acquitted me. It is not unreasonable. I mean, I don't know. Like David, I'm no politician. But it is not unreasonable for Nancy Pelosi to think that that would strengthen Donald Trump's political fortunes. And it is completely plausible to me for her to say that as a matter of her constitutional duty to the norms that undergird the American Republic, the highest value is assuring that we return to a norm-abiding form of government post January 2021. And my goal is the higher constitutional value, and I'm going to do whatever it is that I think would get us to that answer. And if I become convinced as a political matter that impeachment will get us to that answer better, we'll go down that road. But right now, she is saying, I'm channeling Nancy Pelosi. I don't look anything like her, but I'm channeling her. Right now, she's saying, my judgment is that that will actually hurt. And that I will do more harm to the norms of American, long-term American norms by engaging in impeachment. Now, I don't actually think that that's right. I tend to agree with Quinta that we should do this because it seems to me so palpable that it's necessary. But I don't think that Nancy's kind of being a wimp or in derogation of a role. She's playing it at a different strategic level rather than at a tactical level, and maybe she's wrong, but maybe she's right. And so I sort of want to defend her judgment because I think she recognizes that impeachment is fraught. It's really, really fraught. And to jump into it when you don't know what the answer – I mean, I'm a criminal law practitioner, and the one thing they teach you is never ask a question you don't know the answer to. We don't know the answer to the impeachment question, so I'm not so sure I blame Nancy Pelosi for not asking it.
So just responding to Paul and Quinta, what I really think Pelosi is doing, I think she is making judgments about timing, not so much if an impeachment proceeding will occur, but more, I think, at this point about when it will occur. And I think she'd like it to be a proceeding that peaks in October of 2020, just before the election, so it'll have the maximum political impact. And as I said before, might even moot the need to actually impeach because it influences the November results. And I think she is holding her horses in check until they really get up at a steam. But I would not at all be surprised. In fact, I really expect that when she thinks it is the right moment, and that might be 6 months from now or, you know, whatever is the proper timing backing up from October, she will turn them loose and let them go. And in between now and then, she's just trying to keep the attention on this and keep it energized and in the spotlight so that when she does pull the trigger, there will be a very aggressive and fast action thereafter.
So, Ben, I'll come to you for a final thought. Robert Mueller has left the building. He is done. He's out of here. You know, what are your sort of big takeaways at this point on where we're at and where we go from here?
I want to start by actually trying to square the circle of Quinta's, Paul's, and David's comments, which seem very at odds with one another in some ways, but I actually think they're sort of importantly reconcilable. And so, look, if the question is, what is the right answer, just in some platonic sense? There's just no doubt in my mind that Quinta is right, right? It's an entirely non-tactical judgment, right? Just this is the right answer, and people should do the right thing once they've sworn an oath, you know, to try to do the right thing. The Speaker of the House doesn't get to think about it that simply. And that's Paul's point. And I agree with that, actually, that, you know, Robert Jackson famously said that the Bill of Rights was not a suicide pact. The impeachment clauses aren't a suicide pact either, right? And, like, it can't be that if you actually believe that you're going to empower the person you're going to impeach by impeaching him, that you should nonetheless, you know, fly that plane into that particular, you know, allied ship, right? That's a, you know, you don't want to take that view. And that, I think, brings you to David's point, right, which is you want to calibrate it in a way that sets up doing, you know, proceeding down that road, preserves the option of not doing it if you really think you're going to do damage, but also if you're going to do it, does it in the most effective and most politically consequential fashion. And so I actually think it is it's a super hard problem. It's not a super hard question. If you ask, like, should Donald Trump be impeached? The answer is, yeah, duh. Yes, he should be impeached. But the modality of it is very hard. The timing of it is very hard. And the prudential quality of it is very difficult. And so I think there's and that brings me to, you know, where I think we are, which is Congress needs to be very focused and very careful and very strategic about telling the story that they wanted Bob Mueller to come up there and tell for them, and that the report actually does tell. And they have a media problem now. I don't mean in the sense of like a press problem, but they need to figure out how to use their offices and their powers to project that story and talk about that story and dramatize that story in a fashion that is meaningful and compelling and useful. They have a limited window of months in which to do it. And, you know, that is the task. And I think, you know, what we learned today is that Bob Mueller is, as Susan says, he's left the room. He's not going to, you know, make that any easier for them. They got to figure out how to do that. And they've got to be, you know, they've got to function like a caucus in order to do it, which is, you know, not easy for Democrats.
I think that is basically right. I do agree there is a moral imperative and there is also a set of practical questions. And because I'm not the Speaker of the House, I don't have to put those practical questions in the foreground. I will also say, and just to put on my political theory hat, that if you go back and read Max Weber's description of how you should think about the role of morality in political life, he writes that you always have to keep both the ideals, the reason why you're doing what you're doing in your mind, and weigh them against the responsibility to produce a practical outcome, to produce good in the world. And those two things are always in tension, as I think they are in this case, the practical need to perhaps hold on and not impeach, the moral imperative, I would argue, to impeach. But Weber also writes that at a certain point, you get to a line where you have to stand and say, here I stand, I can do no other, and decide whether or not you are going to stick by your ideals or let that moment pass. And if you let the moment pass and act only on the basis of practical judgment, at a certain point, you've lost your soul. And I think the question is whether the conduct described in the Mueller report is or is not bad enough for the moral imperative to take the foreground over the practical implications. And that is the question that we're all wrestling with.
We will leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Audio engineering was by Matthew Kahn. Please give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.